This is the A-side of record 178, President Franklin D. Roosevelt on the NRA, also reviewing his first year in the White House. There is no date.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain of the Senate will make the invocation, Dr. Phillips. Almighty and everlasting God, our heavenly Father, in whom we live and move and have our being, who has loved us into life,
and who doth not.
Ladies and gentlemen, 8.5 months ago, when I signed the bill of the Congress creating the National Industrial Recovery Administration, I said in signing it this: must we go on in many groping, disorganized, separate units to defeat, or shall we move as one great team to victory? That team is before me this morning. 4,000 or 5,000 strong, leaders of 600 or more great organized industries, representing, as measured by employment, more than 90% of the industrial field that is covered by the NRA. And naturally, I am deeply gratified that the faith that I expressed last June is so well justified in March. I do not undertake today to present either a broad review of all the manifold causes that led up to this distressful situation from which the nation is now emerging, or a recapitulation of the events and the measures and the results of the past year. You are here as a direct representative of only one element in our modern, complex life. But at the same time, because of the fine spirit that you have shown, I can and do congratulate you on an approach to your own problems that shows an understanding of the many other problems which crisscross and dovetail into each other to make up the broad objective of the American people. It is, I think, sufficient for me to point out once more that the difficult and dangerous situation into which the United States had got itself was due to the general attitude of every man for himself and let the devil take the hindmost. Individuals were seeking quick riches at the expense of other individuals. Geographical sections were seeking economic preference for themselves to the disadvantage of other sections. Cities were recklessly offering inducements to manufacturing plants to move away from other cities. And within given industries, unfair competition went on unheeded or resulted in vast consolidations whose securities were peddled to the public at dishonest prices. There was little consideration from a social point of view and no planning whatsoever to avoid the pitfalls of overproduction or of selling methods which foisted articles on a gullible public which the family budget could not afford. That's a strong picture. But you and I, in the bottom of our hearts, know that it's a true picture. Most of us participated in the making of that picture. We didn't know as much then as we know now. And because our eyes have been opened, it is entirely possible that future history will call that crazy decade from 1919 to 1929 one of the greatest blessings that ever came to the American people. It was because the situation in March 1933 was so serious all along the line that remedies had to be applied to every phase of the illness. The objective was, as you know, to apply those remedies in the American way and not to copy those which are being tried in other countries which do not live under the same form of democratic government as ours. I'm always a little amused, and perhaps at times a little saddened. And I think the American people feel the same way by those writers and speakers who proclaim cheerfully either that we are now committed to communism and collectivism, or that we have adopted fascism and a dictatorship. The real truth of the matter is that for a number of years in our country, the machinery of democracy had failed to function. Through inertia on the part of leaders and on the part of the people themselves, the operations of government had fallen into the hands of special groups. Some of these groups vociferously led by people who undertook to obtain special advantages for special classes, and others led by a handful of individuals who believed in their superhuman ability to retain in their own hands the entire business and financial control over the economic and social structure of the nation. The fine response that has been given by the overwhelming majority of the component parts of industry, as represented here today, proves to me that you have the same understanding of our broad purpose as is held by the average of the workers of the United States. And that word worker means almost all of the American people. You have shown sincere desire for real cooperation. You have shown prompt response to the governmental request for national unity. And for this support, I give you my thanks. The National Industrial Recovery Act was drawn with the greatest good of the greatest number in mind. Its aim was to increase the buying power of wage earners and farmers so that industry and labor and the public might benefit through the building up of the market for farm and factory goods. Employer, wage earner, and consumer groups are all represented on its board with the government. All three groups with the government must have the interests of all the people as their main responsibility. What we seek is balance. Balance in our economic system. Balance between agriculture and industry. And balance between the wage earner, the employer, and the consumer. We seek also balance that our internal market may be kept rich and large, and also that our trade with other nations be increased on both sides of the ledger. You and I are now conducting a great test to find out how the business leaders in all groups of industry can develop capacity to operate for the general welfare. And personally, I am convinced that with your help, that test is succeeding. The very conception of NRA follows the democratic procedure of our government itself. Its theory of self-regulation follows the American method rather than any of the experiments being tried in other nations. The very fact that you have been in Washington to criticize and to discuss the way NRA is working out is sufficient proof of this point. There are, of course, some people who don't think things through. As, for example, the man who complained in one of yesterday morning's papers that criticism was held to be unpatriotic. Let me put the case so clearly that even his type will understand. If we admit that the government, in other words, the people of the country, have a specific problem to solve and undertake to do it in a specific way, the critic is unpatriotic, who contents himself with loudly proclaiming that that particular way, that method, is no good, that it won't work, that it is wrong to do this. This critic contributes nothing. He is not constructive, and therefore he is unpatriotic because he attempts to destroy without even suggesting a way to build up. On the other hand, the critic is patriotic. The critic is patriotic, whether he's a businessman or a worker or a farmer or a politician. If he says, I don't like the method that you are using to solve this problem, I believe it would be far better if we were to use the following alternate method, and thereupon outline for the benefit of his neighbor and his government a helpful proposal. That's what we want. In this great evolution through which we are passing, the average American is doing splendid service by coming back at the capitalist critic and saying to him, well, old man, and what are you suggesting? One thing is very certain. We're not going back either to the old conditions or to the old methods. And now to be more specific in regard to NRA itself. Because I know you want me to. You have set up representative government in industry. You're carrying it on without violation of the constitutional or the parliamentary system to which the United States has been accustomed. Your industrial groups are composed of two parts, labor and management. And the government is a participant in this organization in order to carry out the mandate of the law. And that law says this: to promote organization in industry for the purpose of cooperative action in trade groups and to induce and maintain united action of labor and management under adequate government sanction and supervision. Somebody, of course, must strike the equitable balance between conflicting interests, and especially must protect the third group, the consumer. And that word consumer means the whole American people. That group also has been in Washington, invited to come here and to make known publicly any complaints as to the effect of any of the codes. I am sure it will hearten you to know that the great majority of the complaints were directed not at the code, but at errors and omissions in what has been done under the code. The great bulk of complaint or criticism of the Recovery Act does not go to the act itself or to its basic principles, but rather to the details of mere matter. In this, we should feel encouraged, feel heartened that we're on the right track and can go forward. In working out that balance on a national scale about which I have spoken, we can list certain objectives. I spoke last June of the fact that wage increases will eventually raise costs. But I asked at that time that management give first consideration to increasing the purchasing power of the public. I said that is good economics and good business. The aim of this whole effort is to restore our rich market by raising its vast consuming capacity. Complaint has been made of a few industries and of some companies that they have not followed this suggestion. And evidence brought forward shows that in some cases, these complaints are justified. What I said was true in June is true now. The first task of industry today, as it was then, is to create consuming power. We must remember that the bulk of the market for American industry is among the 90% of our people who live on wages and salaries, and only 10% of the market is among people who live on profits alone. No one is opposed to sensible and reasonable profits, but the morality of the case is that a great segment of our people are in actual distress, and that as between profit first and humanity afterwards, and humanity first and profits afterwards, we have no room for hesitation. With millions still unemployed, the power of our people to purchase and use the products of industry is still greatly curtailed. It can be increased, can be sustained, only by striving for the lowest schedule of prices on which higher wages and increasing employment can be maintained. And therefore, I give to industry today this challenge. It is the immediate task of industry to re-employ more people at purchasing wages, and to do it now. Only thus can we continue recovery and restore the balance we seek. It is worthwhile keeping in the front of our head the thought that the people in this country whose incomes are less than $2,000 a year buy more than two-thirds of all of the goods sold in the United States. And it is logical that if the total amount that goes in wages to this group of human beings is steadily increased, merchants, employers, manufacturers, and investors will in the long run get more income from the increased volume of sales. I want to speak for a moment directly to the public. In my initial statement of policy, I said this: finally, this law is a challenge to our whole people. There is no power in America that can force against the public will such action as we require. But there is no group in America that can withstand the force of an aroused public opinion. This great cooperation can succeed only if those who bravely go forward to restore jobs have aggressive public support, and those who lag are made to feel the full weight of public disapproval. You all know what happened. We gave you the Blue Eagle as a symbol of cooperation. Its display in a shop or a factory window, or upon a garment or a product, or a delivery wagon, informed you that the firm with which you were dealing was doing its part in this great national cooperation to defeat depression. For the first time, so far as I know, all of the people in this country were given a part in making a law effective. It is a law for the public benefit. Obviously, an employer who pays Blue Eagle or Code wages cannot compete against an employer who does not. And it is therefore common sense for the consuming public, in their own interest as well as for labor and industry, to join in seeing to it that the few who think only of selfish gain be made to play this game with the overwhelming majority. every examination that I make and all the information I receive lead me to the inescapable conclusion that we must now consider immediate cooperation to secure increase in wages and shortening of hours. And I am confident, my friends, that your deliberations this week will lead you also to this conclusion. Reduction in hours, coupled with a decrease in weekly wages, will not do any good at all, for it amounts merely to a forced contribution to unemployment relief by the class least able to bear it. I have never believed that we should violently impose flat, arbitrary, abrupt changes on the economic structure, but we can nevertheless work together in arriving at a common objective. The government cannot forever continue to absorb the whole burden of unemployment. The thing to do now is to get more people to work. Your self-governing groups are not here to devise ingenious plans to circumvent the purposes of the Act. You are here in a patriotic spirit to effect those purposes. With few exceptions, industry will give wholehearted compliance. And it is only in the case of rare exceptions where industrial self-government may fail that the national government itself must and will, under the law, move firmly and promptly to prevent failure. Under the code system, you and I are aware that experience must be the guide for the working out of difficulties and the prevention of abuses. For example, you who are members of code authority are, in a very true sense, your industrial brother's keeper. But more especial, are you the keeper of your small industrial brother? We must set up every safeguard against erasing the small operator from the economic scene. Many years ago, antitrust laws were passed, and one of the primary reasons for their enactment was the protection of the little fellow against the big fellow. In many cases, as you and I know, those laws failed to protect the little fellow. We do not want to maintain that failure. The essential provisions of the code should check or reverse competitive methods by which the small businessman was or is being squeezed out. And these same antitrust laws must continue in their major purpose of retaining competition and preventing monopoly. It is only where these laws have prevented the cooperation to eliminate things like child labor and sweatshops and starvation wages and other unfair practices that there is justification in modifying them. One more subject I call to your special attention. The law itself has provided for free choice of their own representatives by employees. Those two words, free choice, mean just what they say. It is obvious that the government itself not only has the right, but also has the duty to see first that employees may make a choice, and secondly, that in the making of it, they shall be fully free. And I ask that the letter and the spirit of free choice be accorded to its workers by every corporation in the United States. have been seeking experience in our first 8 months of code making. For that same reason, we have been tolerant of certain misunderstandings, even when they resulted in evasions of the spirit, if not of the letter of the law. Now we are moving into a period of administration when that which is law must be made certain, and the letter and the spirit must be fulfilled. We cannot tolerate actions that are clearly monopolistic, actions that wink at unfair trade practices, actions that fail to give to labor free choice of their representatives, or which are otherwise hostile to the public interest. In a word, we cannot tolerate abuses of economic power, abuses against labor, abuses against employers, or abuses against the consuming public. Whether they persist either with the aid of code or despite their burden. This does not mean that we can at once make perfect money-hungry code, shuttling the noble folk and the physical nation, nor that we can get a mark of perfection in a day or a month. But it does mean that we've arrived at the time for taking stock, for correcting manifest errors, for rooting out demonstrated evil. 1 year ago, we were suffering and seizing. Under economic pressure so intolerable, the collapse was at hand.
We had arrived at the day to make our choice, and we made that choice. The American people responded to the call for action with eager enlistment, enlistment in the struggle against ruthless self-seeking, reckless greed, and economic anarchy. We undertook by lawful constitutional processes to reorganize a disintegrating system of production and exchange. The methods and the details of that reorganization may and will change from year to year. But it is very certain that the American people understand that the purpose of the reorganization was not only to bring back prosperity. It was far deeper than that. The reorganization must be permanent for all of the rest of our lives. In that never again will we permit the social conditions that allowed vast sections of our population to exist in an un-American way, that allowed a maldistribution of wealth and power. Yes, the willingness of all elements to enter into the spirit of the New Deal becomes more and not less evident as it goes on. As an example, I have just received, late last night, a telegram from Mr. Francis M. Law, the president of the American Bankers Association. In it, he said this: "On this, your first anniversary, allow me, in behalf of the nation's bank, to express our full confidence and our sincere desire to cooperate in your courageous effort to bring about recovery. The banking structure of the country is sound and liquid, and banks have never been in a stronger position to function effectively. Conditions have improved to the point where it is no longer necessary for banks to be super liquid." There is a definite call now for banks not to extend loose credits or to make improper loans, but for a most sympathetic attitude towards legitimate credit needs, and for a recognition of responsibility for their proper and vital part in the program of recovery. And if the banks come along, my friends, we'll have the three great elements of American life working together: industry and agriculture and banks, and then we can't stop. Think back to exactly 1 year ago today. You know where the bank stood at that time. You know where your own business stood. That telegram from the president of the American Bankers Association is a living illustration of the progress that we have made in that year. Let us consolidate our gains. Let us resolve that that consolidation shall be for the continued progress, and especially for the greater happiness and well-being of the American people.